There is another
mistakenly credited to Isaac Newton, but actually John of Salisbury wrote that Bernard of Chartres used to say that we, the moderns, are like dwarfs perched on the shoulders of giants, the ancients. And thus we are able to see more and farther than the latter. So, repurposing this statement, we may agree that we are dwarfs on the shoulders of our acharyas, taking into consideration the culture of negativity. No? But can we say that we are able to see farther than the latter?
Yeah, we see further when we are situated at their lotus feet. The idea of being on their shoulders is not tenable to devotees. So, and this is the difference. Right? One is an objective thing. You think, well, if this person is here, and then from their shoulders, I mean, it makes sense from the point of view of finite measurement. Right? And that's what is finite measurement. Finite, being added to finite, increasing a higher, more far-reaching perspective than has ever been had before. That idea. They've even gone so far as to say that, I forget the years, but up to a certain point, you know, 19th, 20th century, most of what we knew was accumulated over thousands of years. And then as with the technological revolution, then in the 70s, 80s, then, so much of what we know had been accumulated in the last 10 years or 20 years. And if you follow this to its natural, absurd conclusion, then we would say something along the lines of, 99% of what we know we discovered in the last 5 minutes. That's not a good position to be in. So, quite simply, Srila Guru Maharaj says, the sum total of the finite will never equal the infinite. You can it can be like a Chinese circus with standing on these shoulders and then someone standing on those shoulders and standing on their shoulders, and but you won't reach the infinite. It's, what's the Bengali example? A dwarf trying to capture the moon. So, I mean, I don't mean to insult George Bernard Shaw, but what he's saying can only be entertained really from a purely mundane perspective. And that's the problem. Brahma, Brahm, Pramad, Viparlipsha, Karna, Patava, identified by Jiva Goswami and elsewhere as the four defects plaguing humanly acquired knowledge. Tendency to commit mistakes, to err as human. Pramad means illusion. It can also mean madness. But what is that? Sensory inefficiency, the limitations of the senses, and by that we include the mind. And always forget one. Cheating propensity. Right. Releasing some findings that prove some theory, and then you find out it's not all verifiable or whatever. So in as much as there's no stage in mundane existence where we're not subjected to these deficiencies, then the only option in educating yourself about the infinite is descending knowledge, revealed truth. Sometimes we will hear this statement in the literature of the Vaishnavas, Puranas, Vedas, etc., that at first sounds a little self-serving or jarring, but if it's revealed truth, then it's the given importance. And we mentioned this previously, perhaps when we were reading Navadita Mahatmyam or other places, where often you will hear devotees say, when put in a situation where they're expected to offer some glorification, and they will say, how can I, a finite soul or a conditioned soul or someone unqualified, properly glorify you? And we sometimes it'll be immediately dismissed or written off as humility. Oh, they're very humbly saying this. That's not untrue. Because humility being the recognition or the realization that one is in the proximity of greatness, what to speak of infinite greatness. So humility is a natural outcome of that recognition. So that's true, but the entirety of their statement is true. And it usually follows with something along the lines of, only you can properly glorify yourself. And again, to someone who doesn't study these things carefully, or it's jarring to the Western ear, it sounds self-serving, and they end up spinning off on something like, why does God require so much ego stroking? No, that's to miss the point again. What they're saying is true. They're saying, only you can properly glorify yourself because only you have a proper estimation of who you are. Right? It's one of the perks of being omniscient. Right? That only in that sense, it reminds me of something Guru Maharaj said, what if one omniscient disagrees with another omniscient? And that's another subject. But when it comes to omniscience, that it goes without saying that the omniscient would be in a better position to express appreciation for the omniscient. So then that leaves us nowhere, or we're only to parrot those statements? No. As we hear Murari Gupta, when in the presence of Nimai Pandit exhibiting Varaha Bhav, he's transformed into the Varaha Avatar on his doorstep and enters his house. And when he said, Murari offers some glorification, when he says, what can I, a finite soul, say in glorification of you? Only you can glorify you. And if you and your expansion as Ananta Shesh, who's been singing your glories since the beginning of time, has not exhausted them. And then we realize, oh, that is appropriate praise. So the inspiration in the heart of Murari Gupta, decrying his own apparent lack of qualifications, we end up seeing how supremely qualified he is. And what comes of from his heart is a very beautiful prayer. So, to the Shaw quote, I mean, on the one hand, that's some humility, saying that I just find the shoulder imagery unappealing. But in principle, if he's saying, our present perspective is in thanks, we owe thanks to those who have lived before us, then that we can appreciate, and there's some humility. But the part about seeing further than them, I think, is actually insulting and arrogant. So it starts off humble, and then the humility is drowned out with arrogance, if by seeing further you mean deeper and more accurately, and it just sounds sad to me. Maybe I'm reading it the wrong way. But I prefer Srila Guru Maharaj's explanation, which I think is accurate, true, and expresses more appreciation to those whom we owe such a great debt. He introduced the example of the telescopic system. So he's comparing those great souls, and by that we mean devotees, the devotional eye, right, to a lens. Premanjana charita bhakti vilochanena santaksa deva hridayeshu vilokayanti yang shama sundarama chintaguna swarupam govindamari purusham tamaham bhajami. Bhakti vilochan, seeing with the devotional eye. This is not the eye of gyan or any other thing. Bhakti vilochan, the eye of devotion, the heart that is premic, right? It's saturated with love and affection for Krishna. How is that person seeing? And who are such persons? Gopi bhava rasamritam dilahari kalola magno muhur. The gopi bhav, celebrated by the Gaudiya Vaishnava, means gopi vision, the way they see things. Say, well, they're not scholars. That's the point. Like we say, beauty over power. Another one is heart above intellect. Guru Maharaj tells us that in Vrindavan, heart is in the primary position, and intellect is in the secondary position. And I find it charming and humorous to note that, remember, Krishna is a cowherd, so by caste, technically, a Vaishya. It means the lower section of society, if you put a half, like Brahmins, Kshatriya, halfway mark, Vaishyas, Shudras. So in the lower section, disguised. And so in his pastimes, we hear that Madhu Mangal occupies a Brahmin. And Krishna is often consulting with Madhu Mangal, because as a Brahmin, he's supposed to know what Brahmins know. Like, they know scriptures, they know what to do, what not to do, ritual, they know many, many things. But the reason I say charming and mildly amusing is that, so he's as a cowherd, and remember, this is a divine play, and it's very sweet, so he has to consult with him on, like, course of action. And very often, when he's considering doing something devious, to see if there's some way around that. And at the same time, remember, so Radharani and Brajagopis, they're not scholars, they're not Brahmins, they're not that, right? But they're playing this game that's more intricate than chess and more fun than all these other games. And so Radharani, and on her side, there, you know, there's a board, the pieces are assembled on the board, and Krishna realizes that he's in trouble, like that he's not going to win the game. He's consulting with Madhu Mangal what he should do, what his next move should be. And Radharani, seeing that Krishna's worried and in trouble, says, it requires intelligence to play this game. So these gopi girls can sweetly insult the omniscient Supreme Lord, and it's melting his heart and making them even more charming. So the lens of devotion is not a gyanic lens. Devotion, what is in their hearts that causes them to see Krishna more clearly? It's not an imposition upon him. Like in the world, we are infatuated with someone and impose ideals upon them that may not be realistic or real. Whereas their way of seeing is penetrating the stereotypes about the infinite, divinity, God, and that heart-infused way of seeing is revealing the infinite, revealing the personality of Godhead. So taking that one devotee's way of seeing, that is a lens. Another devotee's way of seeing, that is another lens. And if we speak about it generationally, as alluded to in the quote you introduced, If each generation is a lens, then we're seeing what is normally not visible is not only visible, but so close that it appears we can touch it. Right? So he calls it the telescopic system of the Guru Parampara. The vision of this guru, that one. And I mean, to try and give some credence to what he said without the shoulders part, that keeps bothering me. At the lotus feet is where you need to be situated. But we could say, you see some progression from, you know, Buddha to Shankara to Ramanuja, Madhvacharya, Madhavendra Puri, in that way, just situated at the lotus feet to make it better. And you say, well, doesn't that show we gain a clearer perspective? Yes, but it's not actually based on A plus B equals C type things, but it's the unfolding of Leela, out of the necessity of Leela, Buddha avatar is there. Out of a necessity of Leela, that Shiva takes the position of Shankaracharya and Sri Vaishnavism of Ramanuja, etc., to allow for the bridge to the Gaudiya Brahma Madhva Sampradaya and the expression of Mahaprabhu's Achintya Bheda Bhed. But Guru Maharaj says, so we see the Guru Parampara as a telescopic system. And when I think about this, it reminds me in my childhood when my friend said his elder brother had acquired a high-powered telescope. And he said, you know, I had a star map that I don't know where I got it, but I had one, I mean a real one. And said, if you bring your star map, then we'll see the rings of Saturn. And I thought, this cannot actually be true. I thought, something's not, could that be real? Yeah, because we thought of, like, at that time, Mount Palomar. Now you have way beyond that with the Hubble telescope and other things, but thought of the great observatories. I thought, well, if you go there, you could see that. But on his telescope, because I have my own telescope, I could see the moon kind of clearly, and maybe Venus or something. But so we went there, and followed the map and the directions, because you have to adjust, make adjustments. And then finally, he located it, and then did, you know, the more refined focus. And I remember looking through there. I mean, it was like the size of a marble, but actually seeing with my naked eye Saturn and the rings of Saturn, it blew my mind, you know, about many things. But just that we, from where we were standing in his front yard, that I could look through this telescope and see the rings of Saturn was a hair-raising, astonishing experience. So it's something like that. The telescopic lens, of, generationally, of the disciplic line is bringing what is invisible to the naked eye. Right? Needs the devotional eye. That's the lens to see. And normally, when you put something in front of the eye, it creates opacity. Right? So we are suspicious of this kind of suggestion. Because we're thinking, wait, whenever there's anything between me and another thing, that's opacity, I don't like it. Just in principle, we don't like it. So we dismiss that. But in the case of a lens, this may be the exception. When you put a lens in front of an eye, and especially an eye that might be deficient, as we said, Brahma, Pramad, Viparlipsha, Karna, Patava. Now taking it in the other direction. We're saying sensory inefficiency. They say, yeah, we compensate for that. We have methods of extending the range of the senses. But here, it's an example Guru Maharaj is giving. But what is the lens in this example? Is those devotees' way of seeing Krishna, Mahaprabhu, et al. And no better example than Sri Sri Prapanajivanamritam of Srila Guru Maharaj. In the aftermath of the disappearance of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Guru Maharaj went into a state of deep reflection when he saw, you know, institutionally things were in flux. So he was deeply reflecting upon what does it mean to be an aspiring servitor? And where should you place your focus? So seeing Bhaktivinoda Thakur, one of his works, the Sharanagati, and we know Guru Maharaj has commented on that as well, that collection of songs. But seeing the emphasis given on Sharanagati, surrender, he began extracting from the scriptures the statements from different devotees on the in the six divisions of surrender. And that's what it is, chapter by chapter, a compilation. In essence, of what? The devotional lens, eye, way of seeing of these different servitors. So how beautiful is that? Each one seeing something, so, and organized when there's something similar, but each one is unique. Right? A unique perspective. We like the verse, Gurudev and Guru Maharaj like the quote from Sri Baladev Vidyabhushan regarding Rupan Sanatan, saying Govinda Biram Mandarastira Padam Hastasti Ratnadivat, saying that the jewel Govinda Krishna is like a jewel in the palm of Rupan Sanatan, and like someone holding a jewel in their palm. Sometimes the jewelers, they move their palm so that the coruscating brilliance of the facets, you'll see, like, it goes, the light goes this, it hits it one way and it goes another way. The light hits and it goes another way. So he says, Rupa and Sanatan, they're holding the jewel Govinda, and they're presenting the jewel of Govinda to you. And there are different brilliant coruscating flashes of light or revelation on who is Govinda, what are his pastimes, who is Govinda Priya, his most dear. So, and Rup showing in one way, Sanatan in another way. And Raghunath has his way, and Krishnadas, and like that. It's very beautiful. And the one does not cancel the other, but Rupa Goswami, who is the expert, gives the systematic analysis of rasa in a Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. That said, our attention has been drawn to place emphasis on the subjective aspect, another of Srila Guru Maharaj's themes. So, it's very beautifully described when Krishna and Balaram, like they just had the Olympics in South Korea, Winter Olympics. So Kamsa is having his Olympics, and Krishna and Balaram and the boys are representing, you know, the small village of Vrindavan, which is only, it's, you know, 16 kroshas or whatever. But has Vaikuntha world in its soil. But really it's a on the plea of a competition, he wants to kill them. That's why they've been invited. So they're saying, oh, you know, there's going to be wrestling contest and this and that, and everyone will be there. But really, he wants to kill them. And he has like an A plan, a B plan, a C plan. And Krishna and Balaram, the cowherd boys, they're, you know, village people. They wear village clothes. They're not sophisticated like city people. Again, a Prakriti Leela. Everything's like suppressed and in disguise. That's their preferred way. And when they're coming, they see Kansa's tailor happens to be going through the street, like carrying, you know, with all of Kansa's clothes nicely on there. And Krishna thinks that maybe, you know, we could upgrade our dress for the event. Like when people go, they like put on something nice, you know. And he stops the tailor and said, could we maybe, you know, a few things off the rack? And he said, what, you upstart cowherd? These are the clothes of the king, you know. And Krishna went and beheaded him. Which we can, that's a little severe. <You know? laughs> But he gets Sayuja Mukti minimally, and it is a drama after all, and you got to catch everybody's attention like from the beginning. And then they go through the clothes on the rack, and then Krishna's saying, Balaram, I think you would look good in this, and you know. And there's, and then, you know. so now Krishna, Balaram, and the cowherd, they're wearing Kansa's clothes and making their way towards the arena for the competition. Then on the way, they see this apparently hunchback lady who's a, like, aromatherapy perfumer, Kubja. Trivakra. She's bent in three places. She's on, but she's like going with, and she has all these wonderful oils. We can only, they must be inconceivably wonderful, actually. And when Krishna approaches her, because they're saying, now they're dressed nicely, a little perfume, don't overdo it. And he's asking her for some fragrance, and what she thinks is the best she wants to give to Krishna, without hesitation. She's thrilled to have this opportunity, unlike the tailor. And she thinks, like, this would be appropriate for Krishna, this one would be appropriate for Balaram, and she's thoughtfully considering the offerings. And she's also charmed by Krishna. And remember, in Bhagavad Gita, it says, yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyutanam adharmasya tadatmanam sridamyaham. Krishna had descended to the earth to relieve the burden of the earth due to so much adharma, irreligion, anti-religion proliferating. So the earth, why is she bent over? She's Bhu Shakti. We hear from Chakrabarti Thakur that she's an incarnation of Satyabhama by extension, and she's Bhu Shakti. Bhu means like Bhumi, the earth. Right? So isn't it interesting that she's bent over? She cannot bear the burden of all this nonsense that's going on. It's put her in a crouched position. Right? But her offering to Krishna is so heartfelt. And she's also very charmed by Krishna. He's so beautiful. And Krishna is so compassionate that he, with his lotus feet, he steps on her feet. And then with his two fingers, he put them under her chin and goes like, and then she's no longer hunchback. And everyone sees she's this extraordinarily beautiful woman. Right? And inasmuch as she is Bhu Shakti, the earth, and he's descended to relieve the earth of its burden and restore her in a rightful position, we recall the Varaha avatar. Right? Swayam Bhagavan Krishna has all the avatars within him. So like Varahadev, who did what? With his two tusks, he lifted the earth and restored her to a rightful position. So with his two fingers, he lifted the earth, in this case, Trivakra, Kubja, and restored her to a rightful position. And then everyone thought, oh, how beautiful she is. But due to the touch of Krishna, she became imbued with amorous sentiments and couldn't contain herself, invited Krishna over to her house. And Krishna said, actually, like Gurudev said, some job I have to do right now. But what is it? We'll take a rain check on the invitation. And the cowherd, they're all like giggling and kind of smiling. But we have some job before us. And then they proceed to that arena. At the gate, right before they get in, the plan A is Kuvai Lapida, this massive elephant whose keepers, they have the goad, the famous elephant goad, and that's how you prod elephants with that big rod. And the elephant is angry, and they're prodding him to become more and more angry. And the idea is for the elephant to crush Krishna and Balaram. Done before they even arrive. But Krishna starts fighting with the elephant, and the elephant's charging him. Sometimes Krishna goes between his legs, and the elephant can't see where is Krishna. Then he comes out, and then he sees he's behind. The elephant turns around, he's running. Sometimes the tusks go into the ground and just miss Krishna, pull the tusks back out, running, getting more and more angry. And then Krishna takes the elephant by the tail and starts body slamming the elephant. And the elephant's now senseless and losing consciousness. Then Krishna comes and pulls his tusk out and then stabs him with it. And there's a bloody mess. And then Krishna, holding that tusk, it's like dripping blood. It looks horrible. It's getting all over the clothes. Then with Balaram the cowherd boys, they enter the arena. When Kamsa looks up and sees him carrying the elephant tusk and the blood dripping, and they're wearing his clothes, then he goes, we have to go to plan B. And plan B is the wrestlers. Ooh, Krishna and Balaram dispose of them easily. These giant wrestlers, and they're smaller in comparison, and the ladies are thinking, this isn't fair. They're just boys. And these huge wrestlers, this isn't fair, this competition. They're right, it wasn't fair, because Krishna is Swayam Bhagavan and Balaram is his other self. Whether they're appearing as boys or in any other form. So what the lady said was true, that it was not fair, but not in the way that they were worried. So Vedavyas has recorded one sloka there in which he says, describing this scene, Mala nama shinirni nam natabara strinam smaro murtiman gopanam svajanam satam sitibujam shastra shapitro shishu mrityu bojapite virada vidusam tatvam param yoginam vrishninam paradevate ti vidito ranga rangam sagraja. Mr. Word. Sagraja means with his elder brother. So he has Mala Nama Shini. Mala means the wrestlers. When they looked at Krishna, they saw like lightning. I mean like lightning struck their hearts. And even though they were smaller, like they knew this doesn't look good. Something's not right with this. Mala nama shanir, ninam narabara. And the men, they saw narabara means the, is this not the narabara, the best man we've ever seen? The best, you know, specimen of a man, the archetype of a man, whatever a man could possibly be, this is the best that they were appreciating. Narabara. Strinam smara murtiman. Sometimes smara means Cupid. Smara murti means strinam. The ladies section, they thought, oh, it's Cupid personified. Gopanam svajanam. And the gopas, many came from Vrindavan. Like you see at the Olympics, their people have their flag from their town or their country, and they've all come to cheer on their relative or their local person. Anything. That's the sweetness of the Brijbasis, and they believe Krishna belongs to them. Sometimes we still see this sentiment when we visit Vrindavan. you know, they say like my Krishna. There's no distance between, like, they consider him like family. Like when we saw the girls at Kalihrad, the lake where Krishna and the Kadamba tree, where Krishna jumped into the poisoned waters of the Jamuna to defeat Kaliya, the serpent Kaliya. The girls came and they were like from, I'd say like 4 years old, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, up to maybe 16, 18 years old. And they came there, and they go there every day at like 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon and sing songs about Krishna and the Kadamba tree. So they're waiting for us, and then they weren't sure we're going to stop or whatever, like to start their singing. And these songs have been passed down generation after generation, and they're singing about Krishna and the Kadamba tree, and he stole the garments of the gopis, and he's playing his flute, and wrestled with Kaliya, and all the different pastimes of Krishna. So Swajana, I mean, they consider him their own. They're possessive about Krishna. What a beautiful sentiment, divine sentiment. Gopanam Swajanam Sitam Sitibudam. The Shastra means like the rod of chastisement. Like when people realize sometimes they're suffering for a long time, some injustice, and they realize like the time for retribution has come, has appeared in some way. Pitra Shishu, that's interesting. It's like Shisha means disciple, but means the son of Nanda Maharaj, Vasudeva and Devaki, who are there. Kamsa has them there in chains. And also as a draw, bait, to bait Krishna, to get him to attend. They're there seeing their son, and they're in a hopeless or a helpless position, but maybe not hopeless. Vrishninam Paradevata, the Paradevata, the supreme god of the Vrishni dynasty. Tattvam Param Yoginam, the Param Tattva of the yogis. So as you see, what he's saying? See, the wrestlers seeing one way, the ladies seeing Krishna, another aspect, one Krishna, but seeing all these ways. The gopas from Vrindavan, the yogis, the Vrishni dynasty, his mother and father, Mrityu Bhojapate, the Bhojapati, the king Kamsa, what is he saying? Mrityu sarvaharas chaham. I am death. He's seeing death personified. And Kamsa knew that day when he woke up, things were not going to go well. He noticed different inauspicious signs. Like you look in the mirror and don't see your face. Not good. That'll tip you off every time. You don't see your face in the mirror. You look at your shadow and it has holes in it. So he was seeing an accumulation of inauspicious omens. And now death personified was before him. That long ago prediction that the eighth son of Devaki will kill you. Kamsa, you fool! Right? What is that Bengali saying? No, not about they. They have a saying when people are discussing who's with them, who's against them, and they say, the enemy who will kill you is already born in Mathura. So Kamsa says, Mrityu Bhojapate. Virada Vidusam, others seeing the universal form. One Krishna showing all these different ways of seeing. than with side by side with his elder brother Balaram. So we're not interested in finite versions of the infinite. However well-intended, or that somehow the accumulation of finite is going to cross over in the frontier of infinity. By definition, this cannot happen. Guru Maharaj's definition: the sum total of the finite is never equal to the infinite. So we come back to the necessity of divine revelation. What did Guru Maharaj say to the man and said, if the finite can know the infinite, he's not infinite? Guru Maharaj said, I turn to the man, if the infinite cannot make himself known to the finite, he's not infinite, and shook his hand and left. And therein lies our hope and our prospect, that the infinite can make itself known to the finite. That is a thrilling, eye-opening proposition. The infinite can make itself known to the finite? No, Guru is saying, if he cannot do that, he is not infinite. Is he so inept, an inept infinite, an inept absolute, who cannot either reveal himself directly or find a suitable agent for revelation? I don't think there's any shortcoming on the side of the infinite. If we say, well, what about our side? We start at a disadvantage. Brahma, Pramada, Viparlipsa, Karna, Patava. So Guru Maharaj says in Sri Guru, therefore we need some help. If to error is human and to error is inevitable for all being not perfect, yet there's an element within us that persistently seeks perfection, then would it not be a function of the perfect itself to reveal itself to the imperfect, or that which appears to be imperfect, the finite? The finite and forgetfulness of its relationship with the infinite. So this is the baseline of theistic culture, is accepting the proposition that the infinite can make itself known to the finite. Exploring that. On some level, that resonates in your heart and you're willing to go further. If you don't accept that principle, then all other talks are irrelevant in a sense. That principle has to be embraced, that the infinite can make itself known to the finite. And that implies revelation, revealed truth, descending into this plane, as it were, from the upper world, through divine agency. Tad Atmanam Srijamyaha means Krishna comes personally or sends his agent, representation. So as Srila Guru Maharaj observed about Gaudiya Math, he said, they dismissed everything out of hand, any proposal by anyone, unless you quoted Sanskrit or a legitimate scripture. Then you would catch their attention. They realized we have to deal with that. Why? Because it's revealed truth. We think, well, so-and-so person has said this. They would dismiss it. Guru Maharaj will generally deal with it because he's highly educated. And by that I mean, not that the others are not, but in more specifically, familiar with Western philosophers, writers, thinkers, etc. So if you say, they say this, he could show you its merits or how near or far it goes in terms of revealed truth, and thereby, in a sense, creating a bridge from that type of thought into this realm. And that is something that's valuable. So Like, the common example that comes to mind, Shelley, the poet Shelley saying, you know, what is that? We pine before and after and search for what is not. Our sincerest laughter with some pain is fraught. Our sweetest songs are those that tell of saddest thought. So he's saying, the sweetest songs are those that tell of the saddest things. So Guru Maharaj used this as a bridge to Krishna Viraha, separation from Krishna. Then it becomes useful. And from my perspective, it appears to me that when Guru Maharaj takes a little something from this person, that person, or whatever, and connects it to the line of thought of Mahaprabhu, he's giving, I like to think, he's giving some sukriti to them, that these things they expressed were not in vain, and he's mercifully connected them to the lotus feet of Mahaprabhu, and some future that thought that came from them in the future will be more revealing. Right? Having accumulated that sukriti, the thought being connected to this line, they'll be in a better position to dive deep into reality, as it were. Mm-hmm. So, back to the original point, not on the shoulders of giants, but at the lotus feet of devotees, the lotus feet of Guru and Vaishnav. That's, and from that position, our vision improves. Sadhu Sangha Satovare, through association with those in the same line and who are superiorly developed and realized. Anything else?
Maybe short question.
Yeah.
Why giving or self-giving is oversharing?
Why not? Because sharing means you're still keeping something, right? People want to say thanks for sharing. Yeah, that's all right. But to wholly give yourself to another, now everyone's palms are sweating, they're nervous, are we sure we want to do this? And in this world, that's a reasonable consideration. But when it comes to the infinite, how much should you hold back for yourself? That's why Guru Maharaj said, self-forgetfulness is higher than self-sacrifice. It was a little... It's at first maybe a little hard to grasp. He was saying, well, self-sacrifice is being lauded so much. He's saying, yes, but the highest degree of self-sacrifice is self-forgetfulness. And I'll choose some other words to use just to shock and increase thoughtfulness. Self-oblivion. Right? Which is generally not thought of as being something positive, right? But self-oblivion, in this sense, means, you know, would apparently seem to mean a total loss of self, but not in this context, meaning so self-forgetful to be wholly absorbed in the other while retaining one's identity and individuality. And it's a very high thing and has the ring of Mayavad to the unacute ear. Right? But so wholly absorbed in the other, but retaining one's identity and one's individuality. So that Guru Maharaj's point, and he also attributes this, just to stay on theme or what we're discussing this evening, this we heard in a discussion at his school from the Christian teachers talking about Christ. And again, he reappropriated that, but that's where he heard it, about the difference between self-sacrifice and self-forgetfulness. So self-sacrifice means of what you conceive to be you or what is yours, you're sacrificing that. But in self-forgetfulness, to the degree of self-oblivion, you're so wholly absorbed in the other, there's no concept of your individuality or your individual self while retaining that identity. That's to be totally lost in the other. And on a very high level, we hear sometimes Radha and Krishna are so lost in one another that they feel separation, which is something that cannot be discussed other than being mentioned. It's alluded to in the Ramananda Samvad. And Radharani is so paranoid in a divine sense that sometimes her shadow is on Krishna and she thinks it's another woman. And it makes her jealous. Probably because the shadow looks so beautiful. So lost in the other, but retaining one's identity. It's very beautiful. And it's dealt with in Ramananda Samvad, very high subject, not something that we can discuss other to in a very, and just in a summary reference. But like the performers, let's say they left everything on the stage, the ice skaters at the ice, I left it all on, I gave everything I had, I left it on the ice. We could say, oh, it's a matter of speaking, but I think it's a sincere feeling they have, like, I didn't hold anything back. I gave everything I had to give, and there's nothing left in me. But that they're saying that means they've retained their identity somehow. So sometimes Guru Maharaj would say that Srimati Radharani, her humility and devotion is such that she would say, I have this reputation as being the supreme devotee of Krishna, but it's not true, and I'm so embarrassed that I couldn't give myself wholly to him. She's feeling that way. We know that's not true, but that she can express something like that. She feels, having given her whole self, it's not enough, it's not sufficient. So they never keep a share. And Guru Maharaj says, Krishna says, I won't tolerate any shareholders or liens, the lien holder. He said, I want total possession of your heart. Right, and Pravishta Karna Randrena Swanam Bhavam Sarovruham Dunoti Shamalam Krishna Shalilasya Yatasharat. Krishna should be allowed to enter the heart through the ear, and then as the army, the navy brings the army to the beach, they establish a beachhead. When we hear a drop of Krishna nectar through the ear enters the heart, the flag of Krishna is planted there. They're saying, and what does that mean? We're staking claim over this. And then they start gaining ground. And what is Krishna's intention? The whole heart. Not a lot of it, most of it, 99 9/10%. He claims 100% ownership of the heart of the devotee. And for them, happily so. And Goptrit play Bharan on the subject of Sharanagati, of surrender, means devotee, you know, Rakshashiti, Vishwam, they're taking shelter of Krishna, offering themselves fully, and saying, I offer myself to you fully and pray that you will protect me. They're not making a separate arrangement for their protection. They're saying, I'm just surrendering to you and I'm dependent upon you and praying that you will be my protector. That's only possible when it's complete. Right. Hare Krishna.